music and talk radio about all things all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemon. This episode is produced in partnership with West Coast Women in Engineering, Science, and Technology.
Welcome to Intravenous on CJSF 90.1 FM. We're joining you today from a cool and misty morning on Burnaby Mountain, where we broadcast on the unceded and ancestral territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Kwikwetlem First Nations. My name is Nat. I'm CJSF's Arts and Entertainment Coordinator, and I'm joined here by my friend Ahali.
Hi.
And we're filling in for Robin today, and we've each brought a kind of a topic for discussion and some songs, and we're going to be riffing on that over the next hour until 11. So, the thing that I've brought kind of to discuss for today is this article in... It's an article in The Guardian that is on a... It's an article about a UN report that sort of is talking about how apparently 9 out of 10 women in the... 9 out of 10 people in the world are biased against women, which is quite alarming. And that's pretty much the same as it was when they did this survey about 10 years ago. And, you know, they've done this survey, and it's on about, I think, 85% of the global population that they've, like, surveyed to.
So when was this published?
I think this came out basically this month.
Oh, that's pretty recent.
This report, yeah. And one of the things they're talking about is about how they had this kind of goal to kind of... have the world be gender equal by 2030. And that really struck me as quite, I mean, obviously that would be nice, but it just seemed very audacious, you know?
It's very precise for that fact. And I don't know, how can you just pinpoint a year and just say, you know, yeah, we would be a fair and equal society for everybody by 2030. That sounds very unrealistic to me.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've definitely noticed that the UN, especially, like, intergovernmental bodies, but the UN especially seems to really like setting these very precise round numbers as kind of extremely optimistic goals for sort of, we'll reach global carbon neutrality by 2050 or all of these other things. And, but I think, I was reading into it, and I think this was set, this goal was set in 2015. And it got me thinking about kind of where the world was at that time and sort of what the expectations were and how those were shifted. Because I don't think anyone in the last 5 years maybe would have been willing to kind of pin it, like, we can be have global gender equality by 2030. But I feel like 2015 was sort of still kind of not the high tide, but still sort of the dominant era of a kind of, like, optimistic Obama kind of liberalism.
That's fair, yeah. 2015, but I also think 2015 isn't, like, you know, so many developments, even the aspect of pandemic we need to consider, and, you know, we did not think a pandemic is going to come in 2020, so I feel like 15 years is a very short time. I mean, technically, given the fact, like, you know, we can look at history, it took us so long to even, for women to even to get the chance to vote, for that sake. It's interesting how, UN could just, like, you know, reach out to people, get the survey done, and put the data out. Oh, you know, by 2030, we will be a...
By 2030, everything will be great. Like, I mean...
Fair and square society.
The same organization, the same branch of the UN, I'm not sure exactly what it was also sort of talking about They recently put out something that at current rates, it will take 300 years to abolish child marriage, which is, I mean, that's a very longitudinal projection. I don't know. I mean,
I wonder who does these projections. Like,
They're very, I don't want to be ragging on the UN. I'm sure they do lots of wonderful work. I mean, I know they also do lots of very not wonderful work. But it definitely got me kind of thinking about, I guess, the notion of a kind of a post-progress era, which I think is something that's sort of been rising in discourses, especially since, I would say, about 2016 felt like kind of the year in which election of Donald Trump, the Brexit referendum in the UK, maybe that's not of as much global relevance, but it is to me. Yeah. That's my ethnocentric perspective. And definitely I feel like we've really kind of shifted gears in terms of an expectation of continual progress.
It's interesting. What do you mean by that? Because I feel like, how do you even categorize discrimination in that sense, or bias against women? And it's really hard to quantify these feelings, especially, you know, because we're talking about people here. The other thing that is popping in disciplines, academic disciplines, actually, is this idea of post-colonialism. I think that kind of ties into what you were saying before, you know, the post-progress era. It was post-capitalist era. So that's what I was going at. You know, like, our world is going to be a better place in the future, and we are already entering this post-capitalist era.
That's very optimistic.
It is very optimistic.
I wish, honestly.
Absolutely. But, you know, in reality, I'm not too sure, because consumer capitalism still there, and we are all victims of it. And I don't know. I don't know what I think about it. It is very nice to think about it. You know, it's going to be a post-capitalistic era, but then in reality, is it?
Yeah, really? I mean, I definitely think there's been a little bit of a shift. I think sort of the dominant trend in kind of many discourses, and definitely kind of international discourses about development, really since the 90s, I think, roundabout, has been one of kind of continual progress in these kind of measured terms of which progress is this thing that you can measure, and it'll keep going, and there is no limit to it, more or less, and it'll continue until we colonize the stars, kind of thing. And I think it's interesting that you brought up the pandemic, I think, because that feels like when it was happening, as someone with kind of a background in history, it felt like almost a sort of reality check in some ways on, I guess, you know, what humanity can achieve, and, you know, the things that humanity is constrained by.
It's interesting you mentioned about the 1990s era, because whenever I think about 1980s, 90s, I think of, you know, neoliberalization, you know, Reagan in the States in the 80s, and then Thatcher in the UK, and, you know, opening market, opening economy. I think that's where this idea of, like, quantifying progress comes from, you know. Oh, we are very progressed because we are highly globalized and we have different companies from abroad, you know, coming here and, you know, using our people as employees and, you know, outsourcing labor, basically. And if that's progress, then, you know, how are the lives of these people who actually provide labor measured? Like, do they have basic resources available to them? Do they have, you know, are they getting paid enough? What's the labor standard of the place they're operating from? I mean, we have heard a lot of, you know, incidents in Bangladesh, especially when in clothing or manufacturing areas where, you know, factories are burning down and, people don't have places to stay. And it's very interesting how you can measure progress just in terms of that aspect and not think about the lives that actually help, you know, making profit possible.
Yeah, it's a very, it's a good thing you bring that up, because, you know, the 1990s definitely also kind of a decade of, I guess, the victory of capitalism, in a sense. It was that era of kind of the Soviet Union has fallen, and we're now famously kind of at the end of history, was, I think, the proclamation by Francis Fukuyama, I think, if I'm correct. And so, yeah, it's very much an era in which kind of these metrics, which are, in a sense, very kind of market metrics of kind of progress and equality and development. Yeah. I mean, that in of itself, development is such a heavily loaded word.
Human development at the cost of other people's lives, basically. You know, who has a right to live, or whose lives are more worth more than others. I think it comes back to the basic question, like, do we, like, how are women perceived in this world? And how do women identify? Because, you know, there's a myriad ways women could identify. And I am interested in that aspect of the research. Like, what are we talking about? Are we talking about straight women, cis women, you know, bisexual women? And because they have very different experiences in real world.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think one of the criticisms of the UN's approach to kind of global development, I think, has been this notion of kind of a one-size-fits-all model that, you know, development happens in one way, and that development is this sort of unproblematic category of forward striving that makes, you know, means the same thing in, you know, Rwanda as it does in Laos, you know. And especially as it comes to women, I think you raised a really good point that when you're talking about gender parity or gender equality, that's not a simple and kind of unproblematic notion. And I think, you know, when international organizations, especially like the UN, are approaching this, the question is, you know, what does that mean? What exactly does that look like? Yeah. Because, you know, gender equality is different within kind of different economic and cultural systems. And I think my guess is that the way the UN would approach this, or international bodies that are kind of not inherently Western, but, you know, they come out of kind of a Western developmental tradition, is that, you know, they're basically following, I guess, a kind of idea of kind of gender parity in the kind of cosmopolitan West of, you know, more women CEOs and that kind of thing, you know.
Like the glass ceiling idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas I think, you know, not all economies and not all cultures are the same. And I think, I think part of the sort of UN schema of the world is that there is this one sort of linear trend of development towards, I guess, a capitalist market economy.
I mean, this notion of progress has been, like, driving humanity for a long time, even since, you know, since Charles Darwin, evolutionary aspect of it, and how we as human beings have progressed over time, you know. But it kind of brings back me to the same question, like, whose lives are more valued than the others at the end of the day? And, you know, how are we understanding progress in relation to, you know, because progress can mean very different things in different cultures. And how are we understanding that? And that goes back to how, you know, how are women doing in different cultures? Like, you're right, like, maybe it is a Western-leaning model, like, you know, more women CEO, you know, equal pay for equal work. But that might not be the case in other countries, you know. There are, you know, other aspects of gender parity there, but it would be invisible to people from the UN because they have a, you know, a specific framework in their mind. What would gender parity look like?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's definitely interesting you bring up the idea of progress, because that in of itself is tied to a pretty sort of Western idea of temporality. And obviously, you know, it maybe gets a little silly to talk about this sort of clear divide between the Western and the non-Western, because obviously, you know, we live in kind of a I think it's fair to say, kind of a walled system in which, you know, there is no West without economic engagement with the global South.
Yeah.
Some would say exploitation, perhaps. So, you know, ideas have spread and kind of go both ways, definitely, as well. I mean, you know, you can find endless examples in the kind of Western intellectual tradition of these influences from the non-West. But it definitely is linked to this kind of, you said Charles Darwin, and, you know, it is this kind of Industrial Revolution era idea of, you know, we...
French Revolution as well.
Yeah.
For that reason, yeah.
We have invented the steam engine, and we've invented the spinning jenny.
Voyages and colonialism.
Yeah, and, you know, we've trebled wheat production, and we can do the same to politics and to forests and to kind of everything, and it will continue going on this path forever.
Yeah, that gives me a lot to think about, because I came to the studio not expecting a report like this, you know, by 2030. Everything will be fair and square for women around the world. So it has definitely given me something to think about. And what would it look like even for me personally in 2030, you know, if I'm still in Vancouver, and, you know, who will be around me, and what will be my position in relation to the community that I am in. And yeah, so...
Yeah, it's it's definitely a very branching discussion. I feel like I've slightly rambled a little bit, but it can definitely go kind of all sorts of places. We could, and, you know, we've brought some songs to play as well, if we'd like to do that.
Yeah,
we'd like
sure.
to put one of your picks.
I feel like this was a more discussion-heavy morning. We could definitely, you know, segue our way into songs.
So I've brought the song Inheritance by Ray Spoon as part of my kind of attempts to keep playing songs by trans-Canadian artists, which is getting hotter and hotter, because there's not a huge amount, to be honest.
And I have brought a song by an urban ecologist from India, actually, and their main profession is not music, but then... she writes beautiful songs and talks about the nature mostly. I thought it would be a good way to begin the day.
And we're going to start with Death Cab by Ditty.
Don't tell me you love me, I would only cry. I would only cry. Be took all
This is Intravenous on CJSF 90.1 FM. And I'm Nat, and joining me here...
I'm Haley.
We've just had a kind of slightly rambling discussion about UN developmental goals, but we'll be leaving that behind, and we're going to be talking about...
Women Talking.
Women Talking, which is a movie, and I should give a content warning for sexual violence, if I'm correct.
Yeah, so I recently had the opportunity to watch this movie called Women Talking. And it's a Canadian movie directed by Sarah Polley. She's a Canadian director. And it's based on a novel written by Miriam Toews. And she's also Canadian. And it has like big names like Frances McDormand and Claire Foy, Ben Whishaw, Rooney Mara. And it's a very, very interesting movie indeed. It talks about a very remote Mennonite colony. In the movie, it's unnamed. And eight to 11 women, a group of women basically, hold secret meetings at the barn to discuss the future of them in the colony, because they have been constantly been subjected to sexual violence in that colony by the men. And they have only 48 hours before the men come back from the town, because they were at the time getting bail for the rapists. And it was a very hardcore movie in that sense. And they have 48 hours to decide whether they want to stay with the men, or they want to leave, or stay and fight, or, you know, forgive them. And it was very interesting, because that was the first time a group of women came together and voted. And I feel that is very empowering. That was a very empowering first move for these women. And I did my research after watching the movie, because I wanted to know where this happened, because apparently it was inspired by true events.
I was going to ask if it was inspired by true events.
It is. And it happened in Bolivia. And these Mennonites are actually from Manitoba, and they migrated from Manitoba in 1950s and 60s when Canadian government introduced public schools in Canada. So that's the background of it. And they didn't want the women to study in schools. So they migrated all the way to Bolivia. And this is in northern Bolivia, I guess, in a very... remote farmland kind of area. And yeah, it was very interesting, because I thought it would be somewhere in North America, but it was Bolivia. It's like, oh, there was a migration that took place in 1950s and 60s from Manitoba. That was very interesting.
Yeah, I know. I know that we have Hutterites on the prairies in Alberta and Saskatchewan. I think it's a similar kind of sort of closed rural Christian farming community. Am I correct in that they don't really use technology?
Yeah.
Or to varying extents. I mean, you have like the Amish in Pennsylvania, famously, and sort of related, I think.
Yeah,
that's interesting. I mean, definitely it is it feels perhaps a little sort of colonial in a sense, because they're kind of moving to Bolivia, and I'm presuming not particularly kind of interacting with the outside world that much.
That's exactly what I, that was my first question after I finished researching about the movie. And I was telling my partner that, oh, so I wonder what would their future look like when they actually, you know, mingle with other communities, because this didn't show anything like their relationship with the outside world. But I think it's also fair to say that they did not want to take the name of the place, maybe because of the colonial implication. It was just an unnamed space. The reason I was intrigued by it, because there was a moment in the movie where Ben Whishaw, his character August, he was trying to show these women how to navigate their way out of the village. So instead of saying the North Star or the Big Dipper, whichever, in, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere, they said the Southern Star or the Southern Arc or something. So I was like, is this in Australia? That was my question. It's like Southern Arc. I don't know. I don't know this constellation or the star. And that led me into this whole other research that, oh, okay, this was in Bolivia. Now I understand why it was the, you know, the Southern Arc. So, yeah.
Yeah. And what year was this set in exactly? And it was based on a true story, yeah?
It is based on a true story, and I exactly don't remember what year it was set in. I think it was, oh no, I do remember, sorry. It was 2010.
Oh wow, okay, so this is fairly recent, actually.